Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. So my guest today is Kevin Tulis, who's a journalist, filmmaker, and author of several books. But the reason we're here to talk together, Kevin, today really is because of your book, My Father's Wake, which I have recently read, and which is subtitled How the Irish Teach Us to Live, Love, and Die. And the one thing I'd like to start with that I was struck by is the difference between the two deaths that you describe, which was your brother's first and then your father's. And that's kind of the point of your story, isn't it, really, the way we manage death differently?
Yeah, I think principally what My Father's Wake is about a culture, Irish culture, which still embraces social death. And by social death, I mean that the living and the dead share space together. So typically in Ireland, when you die, there is an immediate wake. Wake is not something that happens after the funeral, the wake happens before the funeral. If they die at home, they often stay at home, reposing in their residence. All the neighbours, friends, work acquaintances come to see them. They're often put in a coffin at home. Sometimes they're taken to the undertaker, maybe they're embalmed, maybe they're, you know, sort of dressed, etc. But they stay, they're taken back to the family house, and then family members wake around the body for 1 to 2 days. They're then taken away to church or for burial. And essentially, it's an open social process in which the bereaved are supported by the community around them. And there's ultimately, there's not much shame or hiding in this process. It's not, people aren't embarrassed. You don't have to be an intimate member of the family or a neighbor. Ironically, more people can sometimes see you dead than you ever knew alive. So it's a vibrant social cultural form, which is inherently, ultimately accepting of death, or more accepting of death than the English or Anglo-Saxon way, simply because the dead body is right there and you can look at it, touch it, kiss it, embrace it if you wish.
And I noticed from reading your book that even children are included in this. They run around the coffin and play, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, you get variations of it. You get old-fashioned traditional wake, a bit like my father, who even had a pre-wake where lots of people came to see him to say goodbye before he died. Then we had a very sort of strong family gathering. My sisters then had young children. They were playing at the foot of the coffin. Sometimes in other cases, you have like a funeral home where people visit the funeral home on Friday evening or Saturday evening or whenever the corpse is actually, you know, a visitation, as they call it. But people would take their children to that too. And again, it's sort of ironic and ridiculous in the kind of Anglo-Saxon way of death that we sort of tried to hide or shield children from death. But actually, it's much stronger and much more wiser path is to show children that death is just part of life, that we go, they're a bit sad, some cry, but then we go home and we watch the Teletubbies and have beans on toast and life goes on. And that's a far more vibrant and therapeutic way of dealing with death. It is an ancient pagan tradition. I mean, it's mentioned in the Iliad. It's mentioned actually in the Epic of Gilgamesh, Sumerian, which is like 2000, 3000 BC. We've always felt this need to sort of do the honourable rites by the deceased. But actually what we're trying to do is we're trying to lay the dead to rest. The living have certain obligations. And we want the dead, in a sense, never to come back. So we kind of treat them properly, give them the right sort of rites. And one of those rites embedded in actually waking with the dead through the night is this notion hidden away that that the wake or the dead body itself is a kind of liminal port between the natural and the supernatural world, that you're there looking after them as they make this preparation to enter into the underworld, Hades in ancient Greek myths. And we've got to do the right thing by them. The ancient Egyptians did this as well. We have to have the right potions and charms and spells and prayers. And then once they enter properly into the underworld, then they're not going to come back to haunt us. But if you don't give the dead proper respect, then they do. They hang around in the living world. It's a reflection of this very, very common psychological trauma that the bereaved often encounter in, like, say, the months immediately after they've lost someone close to them. So they'll say, you know, do they appear in your dreams? And they all say, oh, yes, he appeared in the dreams. In my filmmaking career, I did a number of films about suicide bombing. And so we always used to ask families of suicide bombers, does he appear in your dreams? And they say, oh, yeah, and it's always lush and green. He's in Jannah, paradise, or you're a woman sometimes. So, but there, that's a very typical physiological grief interaction, is that people, even if you live a very sedentary life and nothing to do with war and violence, someone dies close to you and they kind of appear in your dreams for 15 years they can, but immediately after the death, they often sort of appear. And people obviously in past times thought, well, this was the spirit of the dead person communicating with the living. Obviously, many people still believe that to be true as well.
Can we clear up the confusion around the word wake? Because I know in this country, in the UK, it's often misused. It's used for the celebration after the funeral. But what's your definition of the word wake?
So a wake, if you read 19th century Irish accounts, the English travellers, they encounter some cottage and there's sort of people hanging about. And they say, what are you hanging about for? They say, for the wake, for them to die. But the wake really begins immediately after the person has died, ceased to breathe. In my own father's case, he died in the night, just after the summer solstice. My aunt and my sister kind of cleared the room because a lot of people praying around him. They then washed his body. There was almost a bit, what you call it, kind of pre-wake. He was lying in bed. They'd closed his eyelids and tried to, you know, close his jaw with a kind of bandage, you know, in preparation for rigor mortis. And then later on that day, in the morning, we went coffin shopping. We lifted the coffin, arrived, we lifted my father out of bed, put him into the coffin, put the coffin in the sitting room, and sort of prepared the house. And the wake began at 10 o'clock in the morning. And then people came, they came to give their respects, they shake the hand of the mourners. Generally, the mourners are women, or the females of the household congregate around the corpse. You see this in ancient Greek pottery as well. And then the men sort of shuffle around. There's a sort of strange reversion to our biological sex. So the women sort of around there, and often they're the font of emotion, crying, keening. Even in an English, you know, you'll still find it like women in black, that there's sort of the focus. Obviously, it could be a dead woman, but if it's a dead man, you've got the wife and the daughters, etc. And then people come, as you say, they shake hands, they often bless themselves and say a prayer over the dead person. And then they join sort of crowd. And often they often can be very jovial events. I mean, people, they're a bit sad. People can begin to talk about, you know, sheep prices, the stock market, politics, etc. They often recount stories of the dead person. In my own father's case, many men who were his contemporaries, who'd worked with him in different places, came and they began to tell stories. I knew my father as my father, but they knew my father as a work colleague, as a schoolmate, as a contemporary. And of course, there were all these different stories and different aspects. So anyway, you generally sort of settle down. People sit in tables. They're often fed tea and ham and iridescent green ham sandwiches. All very convivial. And then this was on all night, sometimes for a couple of nights, where they literally wake with the body. So they sit on these chairs through the night with the dead person.
Awake.
And that again, awake, yeah. That is what, in a sense, the essence of the wake is, that you are there in the night. You're under a moral obligation not to leave the dead person alone. And it's like an old supernatural fear that somehow someone could come steal the soul or do some damage. But all of these are really embedded supernatural beliefs, ancient pagan beliefs.
And there can even be games around the coffin you describe, ancient games and games today.
Yeah, well, the essence of these wake games, you can actually trace them straight back to the Iliad. So in the Iliad, when Patroclus, who is Achilles' lover, has been killed by Hector, when Achilles decides to bury Patroclus, he has all these games. He also manages to sacrifice 12 Trojan youths at the grave. But they have these trials of strength. Those Greek funeral games then morphed into the Romans, into the Colosseum, into gladiatorial games. And eventually they have been sublimated into what we call our Olympic games. So the idea, so all of this traces back, you can trace it back through the Iliad to these funeral games that took place around the dead Patroclus in the Greek camp. Now, versions of that have obviously gone through different cultures. But in Ireland, you've had, in the 20th century, you had wake games. Sometimes they were trials of strength. Sometimes they were courting games, like almost like dating games, where as teenagers, you went to the wake. Well, we call it for the crack, which is, you know, for, and that the Irish version of joy. Teenagers were hungry after the dance. It was free food, free tea. There used to be free cigarettes. Cigarettes used to be passed around on plates. And then people began to play kind of mischievous games, often with the intention of managing to sort of date one another. Like spin the bottle, quite childish games, really, but all with the intention of both finding the boyfriend or girlfriend who you wanted to, but also deep down sort of usurping death. Here we are lying, I'm 15, I think I'm immortal, I'm lying in the room, or I'm sitting in the room with this sort of old dead person who I don't really care very much about. You know, it's almost like it's encouraging a jest or like an overthrowing of death, mischief. The actual technical name is called a buraki, a lord of misrule, who sort of leads the participants in a kind of dance, defying death and mortality. And exalting sexuality.
And I can see that what you've described is very possible and easy in a small community where people do know each other. I know you said some people turned up at your father's wake who may never have known him, but you couldn't do that in the middle of a big city, really, with people who didn't even know you died, could you?
Well, that's the other key question. How do we know that people have died? Now, I'm speaking to you from Achill Island off the west coast of Mayo, and the local radio station is called Midwest. And it tells me who died at 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and 5 o'clock every day. There's a bit of solemn music. The deaths actually occur before the news. So a bit of solemn music. A man comes on and he says the death has occurred of, you know, Noel Kearney of Ballantubber reposing in his residence. So we know that he's actually having a traditional wake, or actually in Cody's funeral home from 5 to 7 on such and such a night. Then there was saying, you know, removal of the remains, a mass of the resurrection at 10 a.m. on Thursday, and interment in the adjacent fantastic church close by, Our Lady of the Universe. We know who has died. In London, if you had the same sort of local radio station, they'd have to read out the names of 250 people 3 times a day. On the Midwest, it's between 10 and 20. And obviously, people do feel a social obligation to go to their neighbours. Not everyone's going to go to every single wake, obviously, because it's over quite a wide geographical area. They'll go to the wake of someone who they knew in their town. But you are still having, which is an interesting thing, the public presentation of death. And it's a wonderful phrase, the death has occurred. Now, the death occurs at exactly the same rate all across the planet. There's about 200,000 people die every day, 73 million a year. It's an even spread. Wherever you are in the globe, outside war, famine, and plague, 1% of the population dies every year. And you need to take your town, you divide it by 100 population, and it will tell you how many people have died. And if you're in a town, you know, 10,000, whatever, it's quite a simple statistic. The thing is, of course, in the Anglo-Saxon way, where death is shielded, where we feel we need to draw the curtains across, it's privatized and almost held secretly. And we don't know. But that's the difference, again, with the Irish way, is that, could you imagine, like LBC or the BBC Radio Kent suddenly said, and now the death has occurred. And it read out all the dead who died in Margate that day. You know? But obviously, I think English people would be horrified, thinking, this is just terrible. But of course, that is exactly what's happening all over the globe.
I had that when I started my career as a broadcaster on radio in Fiji. I read death announcements at 10 o'clock every morning.
Yeah, yeah. See, it's because people are interested. And it's in ordinary people's lives, these lives, births and deaths, they're the sort of markers. These are very important social events, existential events, historical events that they shape their lives. Whereas, you know, the local county councillor putting down a motion on such and such and such tends not to.
Can you tell me how the whole process of the wake around your father's death helped you?
I think, importantly, I began to see within this process and within this social right a sort of acceptance. First of all, people come up to you in great numbers and they know that you're the son and one of the principal mourners. I didn't necessarily know them. It's odd thing, they don't really introduce themselves, but they just come up and they say, sorry for your trouble. And they press on your hand and you shake your hand. You often actually can end up shaking 400 people's hands. We begin to get a bit of sympathy for politicians who have to sort of do this every day. But after time, you realize that they're not just saying sorry for your trouble, which is some cliche, but they're also saying a kind of muscle memory. They're touching your flesh, pressing in, and they're saying implicitly, he's dead. He's dead. I know he's dead. You know he's dead. He's dead. He's dead. And what you're doing is you're kind of bringing a catharsis of grief and emotion on. You're giving public recognition to the fact that your father, your mother, your husband has died, that your life has changed. People in the community around you are saying, I know you've changed. You've lost somebody. I'm acknowledging that. It's far better in a way to have what people might think, well, that's terribly socially intrusive. But I think it's actually better to have that open public acknowledgement than the reverse, where people are too afraid to say to you in the supermarket or on the street, I just don't know what to say. So let's say nothing. Because, of course, you are going to be grieving. If you've lost someone you love, then you are going to be in grief. You're going to be in pain. And it is easier and better and more therapeutic, I think, for that to be publicly acknowledged. This may not be an easy process, but then the grieving after someone you've loved is not necessarily an easy process. So we have, in a sense, choices. Do we do this in public, or do we do it in secret, in private? Do we grieve alone in our own bedroom, completely, you know, at odds with the world, thinking, why don't they see this? Why can't they recognize the significance of this? Or do this other public Irish rite, which may not be very comfortable, entirely comfortable. You think, I'm sick of shaking people's hands next to the, you know, cold meat counter in Sainsbury's saying, whatever, why don't they just leave me alone? But those are the choices, really. Do we privatize grief and death so that we go through this journey alone, or do we go through it as our ancestors did, together with kind of communal support in a rite like the Irish Wake?
What you say makes so much sense to me and all the people I've listened to over the year of doing this podcast, because so many people are upset at the fact that people cross over the street so they don't have to say anything to them because they don't know what to say.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it is a badge where you're saying, I acknowledge this. And I think it's also important, that physical contact. So they're shaking your hand and saying, you know, I'm sorry. And again, it's that muscle memory. And it's a counter to what John Didion calls the year of magical thinking, where you think, oh, we've got this through, we've done that, such and such and such, and you know, he'll be coming back in the door. She couldn't throw away her husband's shoes, bottom of wardrobe, in case he needed them. And she just couldn't. So that is very, very common. It's another common grief reaction, is that somehow we go through all of the motions of sort of completion, but in our head somehow we think, oh, they'll come back somewhere, or we'll be reunited, or I can't wait to tell her about her funeral.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can't wait to tell about her funeral. Yeah.
One other thing that I would like to bring up, I don't know how you'll feel about this, but I feel I'm a very private person. I don't think I would have liked to have people surrounding me as I was dying, as your father did. Now, are you going to do the same? Will you expect to be surrounded by people when you die? Or would you rather be quietly on your own?
Well, again, it goes to the nub of it, of what our conception of death. Is death something sort of shameful, embarrassing? We pull the curtains across. Do we visit the sick or do we not visit the sick? Do we feel comfortable in the presence of the dying, talking about them dying, or talking about the future? Or do we feel so uncomfortable that we say, I just can't go there. It's too embarrassing. And many people, obviously, as they're dying, can feel abandoned and lonely. Sort of social protocol. It's not that I would say there's a right way to do these things, because one, you have a choice. You have a choice to say, I'm never going to die, even though the doctor says, look, you've got stage 4 metastatic cancer. We say, no, I'm going to beat the odds, or people do that, or else you can be accepting, as my father, but you're entitled to the democratic right to your own death. The problem being is ultimately this is a biological process and you will die. And there's obviously psychological trauma around this for your family and for you. So it's the choice that we make. And I suppose in the Anglo-Saxon way of death, is that choice still available? Is it possible to actually have an open confrontation with the dying? I'd say the other really important thing about the Irish wake tradition is you're teaching a new generation about dying. My father's last parental duty to me was to teach me how to die. And ultimately, your responsibility to your children is for them to sort of become adults. But becoming adults, it's not the sexual it's not the sexual apple on the tree for Eve and Adam. It's the mortal apple on the tree. That people do die, that I would die, people that we love die, and that you have to go on in life. And that is the sort of brutal nature of being mortal. So it's those choices. If we have a privatized death protocol where you get sick and we ship you off to hospital and you disappear, and then when you die, we ship you off straight off for a direct cremation, of which 20% of all deaths in the UK now are direct cremations. And I never see a dead body, and I don't know really how to react. I don't know how to grieve properly. I don't know how to acknowledge that Granny has disappeared forever. Then there's going to be all these problems about grief and trauma, and you don't really understand, et cetera, et cetera. What do we do with this leftover love for the dead? Or we have a more public open death protocol, which we might not like, is lots of people queuing outside the hospital room to see you. Lots of people seeing you in the open coffin, big funeral, people digging the grave, people offering to carry the coffin. All of this happening surrounded by the community with your family at the center of it. So they're the kind of choices, they're the poles of choices that we have. Hopefully somewhere in between those poles, we'll find death protocol that we want and deserve.
And if we can just finish on a quote from your book, which is what you said about your father, he knew how to die. Wake after wake had shown him how. That's what you've just been saying, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, the one of the analogies I use is that if you knew you were going to have to run a marathon and the whistle was going to go and everyone said, right, you're going to run 26 miles and I don't care, it's completely compulsory, regardless of how fit you are, how heavy you are, but you're just going to have to do it, which is what happens in death or sudden death. It would be good to have a few practice laps, even if you're just walking briskly around the local park, you know, for a little sort of half a mile and stuff. And that's what obviously, that's why it's important to take children to wakes because, and to funerals, because these are these little practice laps. We see that the adults are crying, sad, and then they go to the pub for the English wake and have a few glasses of red wine, some pie, and sort of cheer up a bit. And they're a bit upset over the next month or so, couple of months, maybe longer. But they go back to life and people, this is what happens in life. And that's the big question, existential question, which we all face is, regardless of how we say, I don't want to know about it. Someone once said to me, no one's ever going to buy a book about death, whatever. Why would they even want to think about it? But we're all going to die. So we have to find a mechanism personally and socially by which we have a way of containing death, a way of dealing with death in our society. And you either take a kind of training manual like the Irish Wake, where we all go through a certain protocol. Maybe Uncle Jimmy has too much to drink, Aunt Sally cries too much, people have an argument. These are human events too. They're not always like joyous, particularly sometimes with Wake. Long lost children who've never been acknowledged turn up. You can have lots of revelation. But you either have that or else you have silence. So that's the moral choice that we all, existential choice that we face here.
Fascinating conversation. I could carry on for hours, but Kevin Toulis, thank you so much for talking to me.
Good. Okay. Thank you very much, Toulis. Have a very good day. Thank you.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.